Syria. Initials one letter removed from key personnel in GC Greece and GC Palace. Chang squinted. That's what he had asked for. Any connection based on standard search sequences and codes. TB was one letter away from SA. OT was one letter away from NS. Chang shot from his chair and stood hunched over the keyboard. He typed in, "Show interaction." And as the files cascaded onto the screen, he called Mac. Mac heard the car running and footsteps jogging toward him from the north and the east. "Ladies," he said. "Yes? Yep?" His phone buzzed. "Stand by. Hey, Chang?" "Mac, I'll say this once and get back to you as fast as possible with details. Ready? Go!" "Akbar and Stefanich have communicated personally several times today." Click. "Busted," Mac said. "Listen up. No time for questions. Hannah, you're driving. Chloe, you're riding. Take the DEW, Uzi, and a sidearm each. Phones on, radios on. Get to the co-op now. Clear them out, including anything they don't want found in a midnight raid. Then straight to the airport and wait out of sight for Sebastian and me, ready to hightail it to his plane. If we don't show, that means we're dead and you're on your own." Mac bent and heaved the 50 up against his chest. "Time to go to work, big boy," he said. Hannah and Chloe ran around the shack to the idling car. Chapter 8. "Thank you, Lord," Chang said, still standing as his fingers danced on the keyboard. In seconds, he had opened the transcripts of 4 phone conversations on a line so secure that Carpathia himself had once said even he didn't have access to it. "But David Hasid cracked it, Nikki. Access that." Chang also had copies of emails that showed up on neither the palace nor the Ptolemaeus mainframe and were supposedly guaranteed to disappear from every record after they had been read. Hasid's master disk probably had the only copies in existence, including the correspondence. Though he was curious, Chang knew it was irrelevant how someone at Stefanich's level had personal access to the Director of Security and Intelligence. The way they interacted evidenced some history, but if the box in the corner hadn't begun flashing again, Chang wouldn't have wasted the time tracking it down until the crisis was over. He quickly clicked on the box to find 100% primary match, no decode necessary. He opened the manifest and sped read, "Straight correlation from List A to List B, Suhail Akbar and Nelson Stefanich registered at Madrid Military School, overlapping tenures." From the years listed, Chang calculated they had been there together as teenagers more than 25 years before. That would get a phone call returned. Chang was flying now, his eyes darting over the copy, looking for how the ruse fell apart. Stefanich had asked whether Howie Johnson was a fair man. Akbar responded that the name didn't ring a bell. Stefanich told him, "Senior commander under Conrad." "I'll look him up." Akbar found him and reported, "Stellar record, but our paths haven't crossed. Unusual for someone at that level, but it happens." "Don't want to be a pest," Stefanich had followed, "but does Conrad vouch for him? Want to be sure before exposing him to prisoner." "What prisoner? And who's Conrad?" "The Judahite, George Sebastian." "Still nothing out of him?" "We'll break him or kill him." "Break him, I know you can." "You're not Conrad's immediate superior?" "No. Do I need to look him up too?" "You'd better. He's supposed to be your top guy, deputy commander, office on your floor. Send documentation." Later, Akbar told Stefanich, "You're being duped. Johnson and Conrad are in the system. Everything adds up except they don't exist." "Permission to reverse sting them?" "With my best wishes. Bring them in dead or alive, and I'll move you to the palace." As the phone calls and emails progressed, the women's identities proved phony too. "The one from Montreal was in my office." by early afternoon, Akbar had decided, if Sebastian is worth all this, they're tied in tight with the underground. Announce a raid and see if they reveal location. Chang called Mac. The raid's phony. If you warn the believers, you could give them away. Call Chloe or Hannah. I'm occupied. Your location is a trap too, Mac. All right, listen, Chang. You saved our lives. But whatever you do, find Sebastian. I'll get him out or die trying. Chloe answered her phone. It was Chang. Raid was a setup so you'd lead the GC to the underground. Abort.
Hannah, you were right.
What?
Hannah was right, Chang. She suspected we were being followed. I didn't notice a thing and thought she was paranoid.
I told you.
Ditch them or lead them nowhere, Chang said. From what I can tell, the GC has no clue where the co-op is or that it's the meeting place. I gotta go. Mac is calling.
Go, Mac.
Question. If this is a trap, why wouldn't peacekeepers have come back with Chloe and taken me then?
I don't follow.
Mac told him of her encounter with the half dozen.
You got me. I'm still reading the back and forth between Akbar and Stefanich. Possible not everybody knows.
That could be.
It's to your advantage.
Confirm if you can.
Will do.
Mac had moved east far enough to see the lean-to, if there was one. He saw nothing. Not even the GC Hannah or Chloe had seen. That meant the meeting place for the ground troops was at least a little farther on. If Chang was right, Sebastian wouldn't be within miles of there.
Brilliant military mind, Mac. Left yourself alone in the wilderness, way outnumbered.
Mac considered his options and few advantages. He was hard to see. He knew enough not to be lured to where Sebastian was purported to be. He had the 50. He was a long walk or a medium jog to the car, but the car had to already be under surveillance. It would be surrounded, so if he were stupid enough to try to get to it, he would be easily apprehended.
Lord, he said quietly, I'm gonna thank you for keeping me motivated to stay in shape, and I'm gonna ask you for more stamina than I've got. All I'm trying to do is get your man and my two partners out of here alive. Now I'm thanking you as if you've already done it, 'cause I'm gonna be busy here a while. And if you've chosen not to, I figure you know best and I'll be seeing you real soon.
Mac made his way back toward the shack and stopped about 100 yards above it. He removed his big outer jacket, kept only 3 50-caliber shells and 2 clips for the Uzi, then wound the Uzi strap twice so the weapon was snug to his body. He couldn't actually run carrying the 50, but he loped the best he could, staying high on the ridge and following the terrain, often as far as 200 yards above the road. The air was cool on his arms and neck and face at first, but soon his body heat made him sweat. This, he knew, was only the beginning. Mac's muscles ached and knotted and all but cried out, but he would not stop. He didn't even slow. He just kept moving farther and farther west, trying to gauge the distance to where he had left the car. After traversing a rugged stretch with loose rocks that nearly made him fall several times, he finally decided to look for the vehicle. Mac stretched out on the steep slant, facing down toward the road. He set the bipod, his arms shaking from effort and fatigue, popped open the telescopic sight, loosened the connection so he could scan with it rather than trying to move the heavy gun, and searched the road. It seemed to take forever for his eye to adjust in the darkness. The gravel road was a ribbon of only slightly lighter gray against the blackness of the woods, but he knew what he was looking at. At the far right of his field of vision, far enough that he knew he would have to move the weapon nearly 100 feet, he spotted something that picked up a hint of starlight. Only the white car would do that. Mac gulped another minute's worth of cool air, then forced himself up and over to where he could line the 50 up with the car. He was nothing if not patient. While he tightened the sight and made several seat-of-the-pants calculations, he swore he saw movement on the north side of the road.
If he was right, GC waited for him down there, and almost certainly on the other side of the road, too. He remembered from experience to tear cloth from his undershirt and stuff both ear canals. He set an extra round of ammunition next to the weapon, then dug himself footholds. It was a huge benefit to be pointing downhill, because the recoil could shove him up and back only so far. He had to remember to keep his knees bent. Mac's plan was to fire two rounds into the car in as rapid a succession as possible, knowing that he would have to force himself to follow through, because no one who had shot this rascal once, and that included him, ever wanted to shoot it again, let alone right away. He stretched out and settled in, leaving his finger off the trigger until he had drawn the butt of the rifle to his shoulder. He maneuvered it until it lay in a soft spot and not on bone, aware that the thing would still wreak havoc with his whole body. Mac ran through the checklist. Steady, relaxed, pull firm to the shoulder, trigger finger relaxed, ears protected, feet in holds, elbows slightly bent, knees flexed and ready to give. Barely visible crosshairs dead on the roof of the car, a tick left, allowing for wind. Distance just under 200 yards. No matter what the thing does to me, reload and fire again, not worrying about accuracy the second time. It warmed Mac as he silently counted himself down from three that he definitely saw movement through the lens. Unless someone was so spectacularly unfortunate as to step into his line of fire, no one would be hit, certainly not by the first round. By the second, even if he got it off inside a few beats, he expected the GC to be halfway back to the shack already. When he got to one, Mac aborted. Better idea. Go for broke. Aim a little left, hope to hit the gas tank. Even if he missed, these guys had to think they were facing a tank or at least a bazooka. But if he got lucky, they'd think they were facing eternity. He reset just a smidge. Checklist. 3, 2, 1, 0. Oh, mama! Mac thought he had been prepared. It was as if he had nothing in his ears. The sound was so massive it seemed to weigh on him. The woods had exploded, and yes, the erupting of that gas tank and the rebounding of that car on the gravel would have made a sound whether or not people had been there to hear it. The perverse nightmare of the sheer volume of it lay atop him longer than the orange ball rode his eyeballs. The violence drove him back and onto his left side. As Mac struggled to gather his senses, he rolled back to his belly and slid back down into the same position. Fingers fluttering, he wrestled the extra round into the chamber, made sure the thing was generally facing away from him again, and forced himself against every instinct to pull the trigger again. He should have run through the checklist again. One foot had not been secure. He was neither tight nor firm. The butt had been at least a half inch from his shoulder. The recoil sent it back seemingly at the speed of light and drove a ridge into the top of his shoulder he was sure would be there for weeks. The sound was only lessened by the damage the first shot had done to his eardrums. His ears buzzed and rang, and he dumbly lifted his head to see trees falling, two on this side of the road, one on the other. His aim had been 10 feet to the left of the now flattened and burning car, which prettily illuminated the carnage of machine and fauna, all wrought by two fairly simple pulls on a metal lever. Mac wished only that he could have heard what had to be the frightened cries of the young peacekeepers on the dead run. He awkwardly forced himself up on all fours like a spindly newborn colt and fought to keep from pitching down the hill. When he was finally standing, arms outstretched for balance and to stop the woods from spinning, he waited and waited. When his balance mechanism finally made the necessary adjustments, Mac caught his breath, shook his head, stretched each limb, even the one with the violated shoulder, and began to jog. His intention was to jog what had taken him more than a half hour to drive. He would find his way back to where he and Chloe and Hannah had engaged in their sortie soiree that late afternoon that now seemed so long ago. There Mac would find the hidden jeep, hotwire it, and set off on what he truly hoped was his last caper of the day. Surely, by the time he got there, he would have heard from Chang where he might find George Sebastian. And after all this, may God have mercy, or not, on anyone who dared stand between them and freedom. Chapter 9. Chloe didn't know the specifics of the directed energy weapon lying across the back seat, but she had heard the effect it had on a target, and she was curious. She carefully lifted it into her lap, making Hannah alternate from watching the road to watching the DEW.
"Don't point that thing at me, Chloe."
"It's not even on."
"That's like saying a gun isn't loaded. People get killed all the time with guns they swear aren't loaded."
"Looks pretty simple. You know the deal with these, right?"
"Yes," Hannah said. "Now, Chloe, please."
"Looks like you just turn it on, let it heat up or whatever it does, and fire away. It's non-lethal."
"Yeah, I know, but 130 degrees on soft tissue's gonna make you wish you were dead."
"Bet I can get those guys to quit following us."
"Don't even think about it. You miss, they start shooting, and we're not gonna help anybody."
"We're not helping anybody anyway," Chloe said. "We're sitting here with Uzis, sidearms, a shotgun, and a DEW, and we've left Mac up there by himself with all those GC.
And how long are these guys going to let us lead them all over town before they realize we're playing with them?"
"We've got to shake them before we head for the airport, Hannah. They'll never let us in there."
"Shake them? Chloe, their ranks may be decimated, but they've got other personnel, more cars, radios. We're not going to shake them."
"I'm calling Chang."
"What for?"
"I want to know how many people know where we are."
"Why?"
"Hang on." Running was much easier without the cumbersome 50, but Mac had not run this far since when? Since never. No high school cross-country race was this far. This was longer than a marathon. With the slow but sure staccato of his steps, he repeated in his mind, "God, I'm yours. God, I'm yours. God, I'm yours." If he was going to reach the Jeep, it would be only because God wanted him to. This was way past Mac's human capabilities. Chang frantically read every tidbit of the communication between Akbar and Stefanich, hoping for something, anything, to help Mac. His secure phone chirped, and the readout told him who it was.
"You okay, Chloe?"
he said.
"For now," she said. "Is there a way to know how many people are following us?"
"I can try to find out."
"What's your thinking?"
"If it's a bunch, we're dead.
We'll run them around town, and we could try to outrun them or shoot it out with them, but you know the odds there. If it's just one car waiting to tell everybody else where the underground headquarters is, I have an idea."
"Hit me with the idea before I start trying to access the Ptolemaeus mainframe again."
"Why? If you don't like my idea, you don't look?
Is that it?"
"Chloe, don't do this. Mac is in more imminent danger, and we have no idea where Sebastian is yet, so I have to prioritize."
"Sorry, I'll make it quick. If they're looking to us to lead them to the underground, we'll lead them to one. Only it won't be the real one. It'll be some other unfortunate citizens who'll get raided soon."
"I like it."
"That's a relief."
"No, I really do. And I think you two are small potatoes to them.
Not that you're in the clear.
Getting out of that airport tonight is going to be next to impossible, but they probably assume you have nowhere to go anyway, and they can round you up when you try to leave. They want the locals."
"And we're going to lead them to them, only not really.
Back to you as soon as I can."
"Stop the racket or I'll kill you," Elena yelled.
George heard no one else. He kept pounding. How was she going to reach the lock, unlock it, open the doors? She swore and he heard movement. She was dragging something near the elevator. He heard the key in the lock, then heard it turn over. It sounded like she had stepped down from the chair or whatever she had used to elevate herself. Now she was trying to open the doors. Not even Plato had been able to do it alone. George just sat there pounding.
"I'm trying to get to you," she said. "But when I do, you're going to be sorry."
thump, thump, thump. I'll shoot through the door. Thump, thump, thump. You'd better cut that out, and I'm not kidding.
He could tell she was struggling with the doors. There was no way she could open them. If only he could get her to forget they were unlocked. He quit banging.
That's better.
He heard her step up again. The key was going into the lock.
Thump, thump, thump.
No, I'm on to you. I'm locking it, and you can just thump all night. She locked it. George stood and found the other boot. He put one on each hand. Now he leaned forward with his hands above his head, the boots pressing against the doors. He dragged them as he slowly slid to the floor and let them drop. George made sure his knee hit first, hard, then his hip, then his side, then the boots, then his hands. He lay still.
You finished playing around in there? Huh? Are you? You're gonna get yourself shot. You okay in there? Hey!
She swore again, and he heard her on the phone.
Was banging around in there. I threatened to shoot him, and he quit, but now I think he's passed out, because it sounded like he collapsed. You know there's no air in there, no ventilation. Where? I'll look.
She slapped the doors twice.
Hold on in there. I'll get you some air.
Chang found the tape of radio transmissions among local GC peacekeepers in Ptolemais, but the quality was so poor, the conversion facility couldn't turn it into readable words. He downloaded it into his own computer and tried listening through earphones.
Chloe, he reported. I'm guessing, so what you do with this is totally up to you. I believe there is only one car following you, and it's not official GC. They've farmed out your surveillance to two morale monitors. They're armed, of course, but all they're supposed to do is report who you warn about a raid.
But you're guessing.
I have to be honest, Chloe. I'm pretty sure that's what I heard.
How sure are you?
55%,
she laughed.
That's funny?
No, it's just that I was hoping for at least 60. If I can get you to move to 60, I'll buy this car today.
Pardon?
Nothing. Could it be 60-40?
Max.
We're going to give it a go.
Elena was still on the phone, but George had to press his ear flat against the elevator door to hear, and unless she was shouting, he could barely make it out.
On the wall next to the elevator,
it seemed she was saying.
Yeah, gray door.
Got it.
There's dozens of them in here, man.
Well, like furnace, air, water heater.
Yeah, they sound like downstairs stuff.
How should I know? About 20 of them look like that stuff. Okay, 21 and further.
Okay, maybe this is first floor.
Alarm system, emergency lights, outside lights, stairwell lights, elevator.
Different one for vent, fan, or light? Doesn't look like it.
Yeah, all on one.
But I have to. He's gonna suffocate in there.
No, prop those open even an inch and I'd have to watch him every second.
What if I turned it on but kept the doors locked?
Every floor?
So I lock them on every floor. Then there's nowhere for him to go, right?
I'll call you.
George heard her leave the lobby and start up some stairs. He kept his ear against the door and could feel and hear her locking the outer elevator doors on the three floors above him. So she was gonna flip on the circuit breaker for the elevator so the fan would run and he could get some ventilation. That wouldn't do. He had to somehow get her to open the doors. She would be listening for the fan and for evidence of his being conscious. George reached up and felt the fan and the lights, pushing firmly around the sides. The panels were screwed on tight, but housings were hooked to wiring above the car, so those had to be the weakest panels in the ceiling. He pulled the gloves on and pushed hard. The metal was too tough and sharp in some places, even with the gloves on. Elena had to be nearly all the way back down. George quickly slipped on the socks and boots, bent low and stood on his hands, quietly walking up the sides of the car until the soles pressed against the ceiling. He towed around until he was sure he was pushing against the light and fan, then stiffened his legs and pushed up from the floor with all his strength. The fluorescence popped and fell, the fan blades bent and twisted and began to give way. His biceps shook and his chest ached, but he continued to push as if his life depended on it. He felt the panels tear away and the housing break away from the wires. The ceiling had to be a mess. George tried to keep from gasping or making noise as he slowly brought his feet back down and lay panting on the floor, carefully brushing the debris into a corner. He heard Elena hurry past toward the circuit breaker box and flip the breaker all the way off and then back on. The lights of the floor buttons on the panel came on, and he heard a hum in the ceiling where the light and fan should have been. Trying to regulate his breathing, George turned himself around, laced up the boots, and, cat-like, moved into position.
"Getting any air in there?"
Elena called out. She slapped the door.
"Hey! Better?"
George got on all fours and crept backward until his feet were flat against the back wall. He reared up onto his knees until his seat was planted on his calves. Then he leaned forward and placed his palms on the floor, turned his face to the right, and lay his left cheek and ear flat on the floor. He fought to breathe deeply and slow, preparing himself to hold his breath and appear dead. Two more smacks on the door.
"Come on! That fan should be running, is it? Give me a knock if you're getting any air."
George lay there, crouched back against the wall, looking for all the world as if he had collapsed onto his face.
"All right, I'm unlocking these doors, but if you try anything, you're a dead man."
Now she was up on the chair, metal into metal, the click. George was tempted to hit the open door button himself, but he knew she would be standing there with her weapon leveled at him. He blinked several times to moisten his eyes so he could lie there with them open, unblinking, hopefully able to see enough peripherally to know when to act.
"I'm opening the doors, so don't move. I'd rather the brass find you shot than dead by accident."
He heard her push the button, felt the car vibrate with the mechanism, and the doors began to separate. He wanted to drink in the cool, fresh air, but he dared not. In the faint light of the exit signs and a light from down the hall, he saw her in his peripheral vision silhouetted before him, feet spread, both hands on the high-powered weapon. She swore. She took a step closer. She took her left hand off the gun and reached for his carotid artery. As soon as her fingers touched his skin, he knew she would know he was alive. That touch would be his cue to spring.
"I'll do whatever you say, Chloe," Hannah said. "But I've got a priority higher than our getting out of here alive."
"Mac?"
"Of course. Me too, and George. I just can't imagine he's still alive, Chloe. What's in it for them to keep him around?"
"Don't think that way."
"Come on, we're not school kids anymore. Not thinking about it isn't going to change whether it's true."
"I'm just hoping they think they can still get something out of him."
"Well, I had limited contact with him, Chloe, but let me tell you something. He looked like the kind of a guy who was going to do what he was going to do, and nobody was going to make him do different. I'll bet he hasn't given them diddly. Pull over there. You're sure this will work?"
"Sure. I have to be sure."
"Let's just not be too obvious."
"That's why you're stopping here and not at the front door, Hannah. When I head for the store, you stand outside the car like you're watching for nosy Nellies."
"Nosy Nellies?
You know, GC or morale monitors nosing around."
"Nosy Nellies?"
"I didn't know that was so obscure. I forgot you grew up on a reservation."
"Well, I will be looking for GC or MMs. So what do I do if they show up?"
"They won't. They just want to raid whoever we're warning."
"Or at least there's a 55% chance of that."
60.
"So a 40% chance they arrest us or worse."
"You're carrying an Uzi. I've seen what you can do with a shotgun, and I can only imagine what you might do with a DEW.
"I'm just telling you, Chloe, if anybody comes, I'm jumping back in the car, honking the horn, and coming to get you."
"Well, I should hope so." At the first sensation of skin on skin, George Sebastian called on all his years of training, football, and lifting. As he pushed off the floor with his palms and drove his heels into the back of the elevator, the massive quads and hamstrings in his thighs drove him up and into Elena, who had murdered her last believer. George's 240 pounds slammed into her so fast and hard that as he wrapped his arms around her waist, he felt the top of his head push her stomach against her spine. She projectile regurgitated over him into the elevator before her face banged off his back and her boots hit his knees. He sailed 4 feet high and 10 feet into the lobby with her body folded in two. When he landed, his chest pinned her legs, her torso whiplashed, and the back of her head was crushed flat on the marble floor. George pounced to his feet and ripped the weapon from her hand. He stuffed her phone and radio in his pockets, then grabbed her by the belt and slung her lifeless body into the elevator. He locked the doors and left the key on the chair she had used to reach the lock. George laid a small rug from near the entry door over the gore where she had died and used the gloves to wipe up the blood trail to the elevator. He was about to charge out the back door to see if he could find a car to hotwire when he heard keys in the entry door and looked up to see an old man smiling and waving at him. The man wore a mismatched custodial uniform and carried two mops. As he entered, he said something in Greek. "English," George said, certain he was flushed and looked like an escaped hostage who had just killed his captor. "I was wonder if elevators still to not work." "Yes." "Work?" "No." "Not to work?" "Right." "Okay. Howdy, English. How are you?" "Fine. Goodbye, sir." "Bye-bye to you." Chloe set her Uzi, gripping it with her right hand, and reached with her left to open the door. As soon as Hannah stopped the car in the shadows of an alley 3 blocks from Chloe's target, she stepped out and moved quickly. Tempted to look back or to glance from right to left for GC peacekeepers, Chloe kept her eyes on the storefront where earlier that day she had watched the bombing of Petra on television. The place was dark, but in the back were at least 2 apartments with lights burning. She banged loudly on the glass door with the heel of her hand. It would be customary for the locals to ignore such a knock, assuming a drunk was stumbling around at that hour of the night. So she persisted until she heard someone call out, "Closed!" She banged and banged some more. Finally, a light and a door, and a craggy man in a bathrobe and slippers ventured out.
"What is it? Who are you?"
"GC," she stage whispered. "Open up. Just a moment, please." He came, scowling, but wouldn't open the door.
"What do you want?"
"I have an urgent message for you, sir, but I don't want to yell it aloud." He shook his head and unlatched the door, but would open it only a couple of inches.
"What's so urgent?"
"I wanted to tip you off, sir, about a sweep through this neighborhood tonight, probably later."
"A what? A sweep?"
"A raid."
"Looking for what?"
he said, pointing to his forehead and his 216. "For that," she said. "You are a loyal citizen, so we wanted to warn you early so you wouldn't be alarmed."
"Well, you alarmed me."
"I apologize. Good night."
He slammed and locked the door without a word, and Chloe hurried back to the car.
"Well, that went well," she said. "Zap anybody?"
Hannah pulled away.
"What?" "With the ray gun." "Is this how you cover your fear? Banter?" "Must be. I'm numb all over." "I saw no one, Chloe. I don't know what that means. Either they're very, very good or we're paranoid." "Probably both. We could hang around and see if the GC come looking for the underground." "I hope you're not serious." "Of course not, but you have to admit it would be fun. Especially when they ask that old guy if he was tipped off about the raid."
"Where to now, Batgirl?"
"I feel like we're sitting ducks, Hannah. We can't call Mac unless we know he's somewhere he can talk. Chang will tell us what he can when he can. I say we look for somewhere we can wait without being seen and watch for Mac and George."
"You're dreaming."
Rayford had been assigned a tent at Petra and was about to settle down for the night. He couldn't imagine sleeping after all he had experienced. As he studied the stars, he heard his phone, rolled up onto his side, and dug it out from his bag. He didn't recognize the calling number. Rayford affected a Middle Eastern accent he was sure was awful.
"This is Atef Naguib," he said.
"Ray?
Who is calling, please?"
"I memorized two numbers," the caller said, "yours and Chang's, but this is not a secure phone, and I didn't want to expose him."
"Sebastian?" Rayford sat up.
"They found you?"
"Who's they?"
"I just busted loose. Is there a safe house around here, somewhere I can crash until I figure a way out?"
Rayford was suddenly on his feet. He gushed the information about the Trib Force contingent in Greece and how Sebastian could get to the local co-op.
"I'll get to Chang and have him let the others know."
Chapter 10. Mac lay in the dewy grass next to the jeep, overcome with gratitude, though aware that neither he nor his team was out of the woods yet. His overheated body arched and drew in the night air, and he thanked God over and over for having given him the strength to run this far. He had barely been able to respond when Chang told him all that had gone on, but it quickly became obvious that of the four fugitives in Greece, Chloe and Hannah were now in the most immediate danger. They had been followed, were in a GC vehicle, were in Ptolemais, and didn't dare try to get to the co-op even on foot. They were heavily armed, but also inexperienced. George Sebastian had gone from most precarious to temporarily most secure, provided he had found the co-op. Mac painfully sat up and leaned back against the car. He had longed for and yet dreaded this operation. He had wanted to spring George, but the odds were so bad. When it had started, he thrilled to how easy it had seemed to snow the locals. Then it had gone haywire and fallen nearly hopeless. Now, little credit to Mac, the whole multifaceted effort had become straightforward again. Mac now had one job: reunite with the other three and get out of Dodge. Chang was inconsolable over not discovering the connection between Akbar and Stefanich before the operation started. Mac tried to tell him that the whole global community hierarchy was so new and spread out that no one could have anticipated that those two would know each other. Chang had redeemed himself by breaking through the security and the ostensibly indecipherable codes. He and Mac now knew more about Stefanich's and the hostage-takers' plans than they did. For one thing, Mac knew Sebastian was on the loose. Of Stefanich, Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, and Elena, the only one who knew that was dead. Through his fast yet thorough examination of the interaction between Akbar and Stefanich, Chang discovered they had hatched the plan to draw Mac and Chloe and Hannah into the woods. There they would get them to move to where they would be far outnumbered by GC forces, most of whom had no idea what was going on. Even if the tables had turned and Mac and his people had gotten the drop on the peacekeepers, few would have known enough to give away the double cross. The GC expected Mac's people to lead them to the Judaite underground, then eventually be apprehended themselves. Johnson, Sebastian, Jinnah, and Irene would be reunited at local GC headquarters, then carted off to New Babylon as feathers in the cap of Stefanich, the newest palace member of Akbar's staff.
"Stefanich is beside himself looking for you," Chang had told Mac. "They were worried when they couldn't get through to Elena for a while, but they have reached her now and have been assured everything is fine at headquarters."
"What do you make of that, Chang?"
"I don't worry about it. Sebastian confirmed the Elena kill, and he has her phone. Who knows how he bluffed them? I wouldn't put anything past him. My worry is for Chloe and Hannah. The morale monitors lost them after the women led them to what the MMs thought was the co-op. They won't know that was phony till they raid it. But Stefanich had so many of his people in the woods to help bring you three back, he was short on help in Ptolemais. That's all changed now. Everybody's on their way back."
The problem for Mac, he realized as he hotwired the jeep, was that he could call Chloe and Hannah,
but he couldn't reach the co-op or Sebastian except in person. He had an idea of how they might all escape, but the women had to stay safe in the meantime.
"How bizarre is that?" Chloe said. "We were probably walking distance from George when he came out the back door of GC headquarters. We could have driven him to the co-op."
"And ruined it for everybody."
"Well, yeah, but I'm just saying, we've got to ditch this car and get where Mac can find us."
"The sooner the better," Hannah said. "I haven't noticed anyone for quite a while. Let's do it now."
"Let's at least get to the outskirts."
"Risky."
"Not as risky as parking in town and walking through the streets."
Mac hated the thought of having to walk even a few blocks, but he couldn't risk parking anywhere near the co-op. He left the Jeep about a mile north and set off on foot. The trick would be to get in without getting shot, with those at the co-op on the lookout for GC. He thought about just waltzing into the pub above, but for all he knew, Socrates had described him, and the whole town was watching for him. He was still in camouflage and armed with an Uzi, not your typical Ptolemaist out for a nightcap. Instead, Mac went by what Chloe and Hannah had told him of the place and stayed in the shadows, coming the far way around, slipping in the back door and into the tiny bathroom. The pub was full and noisy, and that was to his advantage. He locked the door, tried not to inhale deeply, and scrubbed the grease from his face. Mac didn't look much cleaner in the dingy mirror, and he was struck by the fatigue showing around his eyes. "Some night," he thought, "and we've just started." Mac studied the pipes. They ran straight down through the floor, probably just a few feet from George and who knew how many local believers huddled in the back room of the laundry. He sat on the floor and used an Uzi clip to tap in Morse code on the pipe. "Seeking friend from SD. He repeated the message twice more. Finally, return taps. Mac had nothing to write with, so he had to remember each letter. "Need assurance," Mac responded. "Amazing grace," the reply. "More," he tapped out. "Let's go home." Back came, "Favorite angel?" That was easy, and only a compatriot would know that. "Michael." "Welcome. Hurry." Mac turned out the light before he opened the door, saw no curious eyes, and hurried down the stairs. He heard a psst from the back room and ducked through the curtain, only to look down the barrels of two Uzis in the dim light. A young dark-haired man appeared ready to shoot.
"Let me see your hands."
Mac raised them, his own Uzi supplied from that very room, dangling from his arm.
"Is that him?" the young man asked.
"Could be," George said.
"If it's not," Mac said, "how do I know you're Costas?"
Then he realized why George had to be waffling and whipped off his glasses.
"I used to work for Carpathia, man. The freckles had to go and the hair color had to change."
"That's him," George said, stepping forward to embrace Mac.
Several others, mostly men, all ages and all armed, emerged from under piles of clothing. Only three women were there, one middle-aged, one elderly, and one in her late teens. The first introduced herself as Costas's mother, Mrs. P. The older said,
"My husband is Kay's cousin."
A thin, wiry man who looked to be in his late 70s said,
"That would be me."
George pointed at the teenager. "This one answered Elena's phone a little while ago. Despite a very bad connection and a lot of static, she assured her partners I was still safely locked away."
"Nice to meet you,"
the girl said, adding the staticky sound as she spoke and causing the others to smile.
"Excellent work," Mac said. "Now, brothers and sisters, we have no time. There is a massive manhunt for me, and it won't be long before they find out Elena is dead and their prisoner gone. I have two compatriots on foot. Kay's cousin. Are you also a Kronos?"
"I am, sir."
"Are you the one who lent your truck to the cause?"
He nodded solemnly.
"And is that truck available?"
2 blocks from here.
I want to buy it. Mac pulled a huge wad of nicks from a pocket below his knee.
No, not necessary.
Actually, it is, because by the end of the night it will be well known to the GC, and you will be unable to be seen in it again.
I do not need the money.
Does the co-op, the underground?
Yes, Mrs. Pappas said, and she stepped forward to take it.
Tell me about the truck. 4-wheel drive?
Yes, but not new, not fast. 5-speed manual transmission, very heavy and powerful.
As soon as I connect with my other 2 team members, George and I will take the truck and pick them up. The GC expects us to head for the Ptolemais airport, but that's a suicide run. We have a plane at an abandoned strip 80 miles west of here. If we can head that way without attracting attention, that's where you'll find the truck tomorrow. If we draw a tail, pretend you never saw that truck.
I want to come, Costas said.
I'm sorry, no. Unless you are going all the way to America with us, there would be no way for you to help us and to also escape.
But I...
We will accept all the ammunition you can spare. I would say if we leave now, our chances are only about 50-50. Agree, George?
No, sir. I think that's optimistic. But I agree it's our only option, and we need to go now.
Mrs. P. held up a hand.
There is nothing wrong with working while someone is praying. Someone put extra ammunition clips in a bag while I pray. Our God, we thank you for our brothers and sisters in Christ, and ask you to put around them a fiery ring of protection. Give them Godspeed, we pray, in the name of Jesus. Amen.
George took the bag and got the keys and directions to the truck while Mac huddled in a corner and tried to bring up Hannah and Chloe on his walkie-talkie. Chloe was on the phone to Chang when she heard Hannah take a radio message from Mac and give their location, off the road and behind underbrush north of the city.
This is urgent, Chang was saying. I don't have time to call everybody individually, so get this. All Ptolemais GC peacekeepers and morale monitors are on high alert. They have abandoned the woods and are beginning a sweep of the entire town. We're talking hundreds of personnel and all working vehicles. They've found Elena's body, know they were the victims of an imposter on her phone, and are tracing that phone with GPS. If George has it, they'll know where he is, and if he ditches it, it needs to be far from the co-op. The airport is crawling with GC, and though the rooster tail is sitting on the tarmac as if it's ready to go, it has been drained of fuel. If you can't get back to Mac's plane, the best I can offer is to try to get Abdullah's pilot friend to Larnaca on Cyprus tomorrow.
Thanks, Chang, Chloe said. Hannah tells me Mac and George are on their way. Forget Larnaca. We'd never get there. It sounds like the net is being drawn in all around us. Tell everyone we love them and that we're doing our best to get home.
Mac was driving toward the North Road with George in the passenger's seat when he got the call from Chloe about Elena's phone.
That's easy, he said, stopping in the middle of the road.
Stick Elena's phone under the front tire, George, he said.
The truck flattened the phone.
As they reached the North Road, Mac saw a sea of flashing blue lights in the distance.
We're toast, he said.
They're not looking for this truck, George said. Don't do anything suspicious.
Like picking up 2 armed women?
Drive on. The women will see the GC and know we'll have to come back.
When would we have time to do that?
What are you going to do, Mac?
They're setting up a roadblock. Stick the weapons and ammo under the seats and get a cap on. There's a better description of you than me out there.
You can't hide big, but you can cover blonde.
Chloe and Hannah lay on their stomachs, watching the long line of GC cars, lights flashing.
There's the truck, Hannah said. Most of the GC are driving by them. Guess they don't need all those for a roadblock.
One GC car stopped on each side of the road, and a peacekeeper held up a hand to stop the truck and wave through the rest of the squad cars.
Hannah, if you can hear me, give me 1 click.
Chloe looked at her.
Was that George?
Hannah nodded and clicked her walkie-talkie. All right, I've got Mac's radio in the seat here, and I'm staring straight ahead and pretending not to be talking, so I may be hard to hear. Listen carefully. If you have the DW with you and can turn it on, give me a click. Hannah turned on the weapon and gave another click. These guys are going to check us out. I'll leave the radio locked open. If it sounds like they're going to look closer, incapacitate both of them. Understand? Click. Here they come. Stand by. If one comes to my side of the truck, please use very careful aim. Click. Chang was exhausted and wished he could call it a night like most everyone else at the palace except Suhail Akbar and the literally indefatigable Carpathia himself, who didn't require sleep anymore. Chang wouldn't, however, be able to sleep anyway until Mac and Chloe and Hannah and George were safely in the air. He stayed at his computer, available to help. Meanwhile, he tapped into Carpathia's office. I really must stay on top of this grease thing, Akbar was saying. I'll return as soon as I can.
Is it not something you can do from here, Suhail? The nights are so long and there is much to learn from the daylight regions.
Forgive me, Potentate, but we have had a serious breach of security. I am on a secure phone to Ptolemaeus and on a secure email connection. The situation is about to be resolved and I will hurry right back.
And we can see how the morale effort is going in Region 6 and in Region 0.
Of course.
There should be audio and video feeds where I see the last holdouts taking the loyalty mark, worshipping my image 3 times a day, or suffering the consequences. They are suffering, are they not?
I'm sure they are, Excellency. I don't know how you or I could have been clearer on that.
And the Jews? There are many Jews in both those regions who might be enjoying the sunshine right now, but who do not know that this is their last chance to see it. Am I right?
You are always right, Highness. However, few people anywhere are truly enjoying anything with the seas as they are. I don't know how the planet can survive such a tragedy.
This is the work of the Judahites, Suhail. They tell the Jews they are God's chosen. Well, they are my chosen ones now, and what I have chosen for them will taste bitter in their mouths. I want to see it, Suhail. I want to know my edicts are being carried out.
I will see to it, my lord. By the time I return, someone will hook up the monitor to reporting stations in those regions so you may be brought up to date.
This security breach, Suhail, it is here inside the palace.
That's all we can conclude, sir. If such misleading, wholly false information can be planted on our main database from a remote location, we are much more vulnerable than we imagined. Bad as it is, we are most certain it is coming from inside, and that should not take long to trace.
You remember, Suhail, what I have asked for in the way of treatment of the Jews, not to mention the Judahites. That would be retribution far too lenient for one under my own roof who would deceive me in such a way.
I understand, sir. The perpetrator must be put to death before the eyes of the world.
Of course. Suhail, have we not combed our entire personnel list?
We have.
And are there any employees of the global community here or anywhere in the world who have yet to receive the mark?
Less than 0.001%, Excellency. Probably fewer than 10, and all loyalists with valid reasons and all, to the best of our knowledge, with plans to rectify the situation immediately.
But should they not be our primary suspects?
We have them closely watched, sir, and there is not one employee in the palace or in New Babylon without the mark.
After Suhail was finally able to excuse himself and get back to the situation in Ptolemaeus, Chang kept listening to Carpathia's office. Nikolai mumbled under his breath, but Chang couldn't make it out.
Occasionally he heard banging as if Carpathia was pounding on a table or desk. Finally he heard a clatter that sounded like Carpathia had kicked a wastebasket and stuff spilled out. After a few moments, Chang heard a faint knock and Carpathia calling out, "Enter!"
"Oh, excuse me there, Potentate, sir. I'm to get your monitor hooked up to the United North American States and the United South American States."
Carpathia ignored him until the man was on his way out.
"Clean up this mess," he said.
Mac decided to take the initiative with the GC peacekeeper in charge of the roadblock and not wait to be asked for his papers. George was slouched in the passenger seat.
"Wow, what you got going tonight there, Chief? I haven't seen this many of you guys on the streets since I started working road maintenance. All these guys are making it hard on our construction zones, but you gotta do what you gotta do. What are you looking for, anyway? Something I can be watching for?"
"Confidential matter, sir. High-level manhunt. Long day for you guys, huh?"
"Tell me about it. We're hardly ever out this late. Had to come back around the long way from the airport. That part of this deal? That place is locked up tight. Went through the roadblock there, too. They cleared us, even though we don't have our papers on us, 'cause we had to work so late, asphalt and all. Going back to the workshed now."
"That's no excuse to not have your papers. Everybody is supposed to have their papers all the